Scribbler's Corner is brought to you by Brad Kuhn and Associates and the Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Scribbler's Corner, the podcast about writers and writing, broadcasting from River of Grass Studios, where two rivers meet and you never know who will tie up to the dock for a chat and a fresh cup of coffee. I'm Darlin Finch Kuhn, but my friends call me the Scribbler. Emily K. Michael is a blind poet, musician, and writing instructor from Jacksonville, Florida. Since 2016, she has worked as the associate poetry editor for Word Gathering, a journal of disability poetry and literature. Her poetry and essays have appeared in Word Gathering, The Hopper, Artemis Journal, The South Carolina Review, The Deaf Poets Society, 9 Mile Magazine, Bridge 8, Narrative Inquiry in Bioethics, Brevity's Nonfiction Blog, Barriers and Belonging, and AWP Writer's Notebook. Her first chapbook manuscript, Natural Compliance, won honorable mention in the Hopper's 2016 Prize for Young Poets. And her first published chapbook is Neoteny, and it is available for pre-order from Finishing Line Press. Emily, we're so happy to have you here at River of Grass. And tell me who this beautiful young black gentleman is on the floor here at your feet that you brought along with you.
Well, you're going to hear him jingling, and that is York. He's my guide dog.
Oh, he is such a good boy and very pretty. We're glad to have both of you here today. So you have a new book coming out.
I do. It's exciting.
Tell me all about it.
So Neoteny is a chapbook. It's about 34, 35 poems. And I sent it into a chapbook contest last year in 2018. And it did not win, but the publisher contacted me anyway and said we'd love to publish it. So it's
that
my first...
like a win to me.
Yeah, exactly. So... it's my first solo collection. I've had my work published in journals and anthologies, and this is the first one that's all me, so it's very exciting.
Now, it has a beautiful cover, and I understand that the artist is a friend of yours.
She is. That's local photographer Chelsea Whiteman. She's a UNF graduate, and she also works on campus with me at UNF. And she did my author photos as well, so I'm a big fan of her work.
Nice, yeah, and they're lovely too. Tell me what the word neoteny means.
Neoteny is a concept I borrowed from biology. It's the idea of retaining the characteristics of the juvenile stage into adulthood. So species that are highly neotenous are species that are very playful after they have passed through childhood. And generally, the more neotenous a species is, the more successful they are and the more intelligent they are. So scientists identify rats, dolphins, whales as neotenous. They're very playful even into adulthood. And humans are the most neotenous species.
Yeah, I've known some very neotenous people without knowing that I knew them.
Sure.
that's an interesting new word that you've given me, so I thank you for that. I found that you and I have a literary figure in common that we're very, very much a fan of, and it's the first poem in your new collection, from Little Women, Jo March. And so tell me about how that poem came about.
You know, I love Little Women. It's one of those comfort books that I reread when I'm depressed or stressed or overwhelmed. And I've read a lot of history about it and analysis of it, but I just keep going back to the book. I read it as a teenager or a young girl and then reread it again. And maybe last year or the year before, I read it again. And I suddenly found all this emotional depth that I had never found before. I always identified with Jo. I think probably so many female writers can say they identified with Jo. But, you know... there's the part of the book where Jo is, everybody's married and everybody has moved on and everybody has their families and she doesn't feel that she fits in anywhere. And her sister has died and she's kind of the odd piece in her family. And everybody loves her. It's not that they don't love her, but she's very lonely. And I had never noticed that as a young girl reading the book. I had never noticed that as a teenager. But when I read it again, I felt that loneliness and I felt that ache and I thought, wow. And so it never occurred to me that that book had a feeling that I would feel but hadn't felt yet, you know? So I got up one morning, I had listened to the book before I went to bed, and I got up the next morning and I sat down and wrote that poem, and it pretty much shook out on the page exactly how it is now. There's a very, very, very few adjustments I made. And it was just incredible to me to think that there was such a depth in the book that I had not found yet, because I don't think I was mature enough to find that yet. And there is a loneliness in your life when you're waiting for something else to happen, and it may not be marriage, it may not be romance necessarily, but Joe was on the cusp of something toward the end of that book, before the professor comes back into her life, and I felt that. And it was this weird emptiness, this achy emptiness. And so when I wrote that poem, it was a way to deal with that feeling.
Would you read the poem for
sure.
us?
I begin to understand Joe March. I wanted her wildness, tramp of russet boots, hair bundled, she defied all ornaments. I wanted energy to overturn expectations. Now all my sisters are mothers, and plump little palms tap at my door, make anti-nonsense of my name. I miss the sisterhood gone. I ache in that self-conscious corner of my heart, where other joys crowd, hope, restless and springy underfoot, shoulders old beliefs aside, I recognize the step of a returning friend. I tune my ears to his laugh at the gate and lean against him as we cross the green ground.
That is absolutely beautiful. And as someone who has read and reread and loved that book all my life, it's amazing to hear that emotion expressed by another person who mm-hmm. loves the book just as well. And I was happy to hear from you that the gentleman at the gate has actually appeared for you.
He has.
Tell yes. us about that.
Oh, goodness. Poetically or accurately?
Tell us in real life that about your engagement, and then I'd love to hear you read another poem that expresses some of that, those good things that are happening.
So actually, like Joe March, the special person in my life has been in my life a long time. It's my best friend, Joel, who has someone that I met back in 2010. He was my first friend I made in grad school. So we were in an old English class together, actually. And I had asked for help getting to and from class because campus was so crowded, full of geese and, you know, maintenance men and, you know, protesters on the green. I never felt like I could get to my classes easily by myself. So he had answered my email and said he would be happy to walk to class with me. And I had my doubts because I had walked to class with some pretty weird people who had been really obnoxious. And so I thought, oh, well, let me just take this with a grain of salt. And so he came up to me and just started talking. And the more he talked, the more comfortable I became. And we were really good friends in grad school, and we kept in touch and then reconnected a few years ago. And I remember sitting across from him and thinking I could talk to this guy forever. And then I looked at him and I thought, has he always been that cute? And I thought, uh-oh, what's going on? This is weird. So the feelings were new. I'm not a terribly romantic person. And so those feelings were weird. I thought, well, that's weird. And I thought, I can't stop thinking about him. I can't stop talking about him. Something's happening to me. I don't know what it is. So we started dating, and it's been wonderful. And then we got engaged a few months ago. And the poem that you mentioned is called Anniversary in St. Augustine. And it was our first anniversary together. And we went and walked around historic St. Augustine. And Joel is kind of a rebel in some ways. And so we didn't walk with the tour. We did our own. And so he took me into all the little buildings and houses. And we handled a bunch of stuff we probably weren't supposed to touch, you know. But he was determined that I would have the full historic experience, and so he said, let's touch the old printing press, and let's touch all the props, and hopefully none of the San Agustino authorities are listening to this because we touched everything. So I wrote a poem about that, and that's actually coming out for publication this month as well. So let's see.
You know, while you're getting your iPad there ready to take a look and read that poem, I thought I have a rather wonderful suggestion for your second poetry collection. I think you should call it Geese, Maintenance Men, and Protesters. I thought, you know, you just don't hear a sentence like that every day of the week.
I love it. That's great.
So you'll read to us from your anniversary poem.
So this is called Anniversary in St. Augustine. We blessed the Florida autumn and ate bacon sandwiches under gray clouds. I drank hot chai for a sore throat. He held my hand. We drove 2 hours to walk the old quarter, traded $30 for 300 years. Hollow houses, tiny plaques, costumed guides interrupted, joyful crunches on studied gravel. He wanted to climb the old watchtower, gambled up the steps like a boy. I stayed on the second landing, dizzy with kisses. In the colonial newspaper office, he guided my hands to a huge wooden printing press. He said, I bet we're not supposed to touch this. He helped me learn its levers and knobs.
That is wonderful. That is wonderful. How do you know when an experience or an emotion is going to turn into a poem for you or some other form of writing, maybe an essay or short story?
I think it just bugs me, and then not in a bad way, but it hangs out in my head and I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop wanting to put words to it. An essay for me is generally something that's more fleshed out. It's more narrative. I write a lot of essays and I feel very comfortable writing essays, but they're much more of an explanation of what's happening. And they are narrative because I usually use storytelling in a lot of my essays. But for me, experiences like the St. Augustine one or the Joe March poem, they're very emotionally intense. And maybe they're a poem because I want to process those emotions and turn them into something I can handle. Or maybe they're a poem because there's no way to explain them. You just have to give people a handful of metaphors and say, okay, figure it out.
Absolutely. And I wonder, how do you decide what metaphors to use? How do you select out of all the senses that you have and all of the possible words that sound a certain way or have a certain rhythm? How do you decide the perfect way to express something?
That's a tough question.
I'm a tough interviewer.
I know. I love noisy poems. I love poems with a lot of sound going on. I love all the devices. I love the alliteration. But how to pick, I don't know. I don't know that it's a logical process and that I'm not kind of cycling through different words in a very logical way. I think I put words on the page and try them out, and maybe they don't work, so I switch them out with others, but it's not at all a logical process, or it doesn't feel logical to me. It feels very emotion-driven, and I think about how could I create this emotion for somebody else. I do love like the neatness of certain expressions, like in the St. Augustine poem, I said we traded $30 for 300 years. Mm-hmm. It was $20, but $20 for 300 years doesn't sound as good.
No.
You know, so I
poetic license.
Yes, I tweaked that a bit. Yeah. I like the idea of doing things with words that you don't expect. So, like in the Joe March poem, I said, where other joys crowd, and you don't think of joy as being a crowdy emotion that, you know, jostles something aside. Mm-hmm. And so I like to kind of say, okay, there's something in that poem about the fact that everyone else is so happy, and Joe March and the speaker of that poem are not happy, but they're crowded in by other people's happiness. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's like, well, what kind of, you know, there are complicated joys where you know you're supposed to be happy and you're so happy for everyone else, but something's not quite right for you. And so instead of joy having, you know, bird-like qualities, it lifts you up, it's soaring, you know, it's beautiful. Mm. It could be unruly. It could be crowding you. It could kind of be elbowing you. And so I think about that, and I think sometimes having more fun, being willing to talk about things like that, that are not so neatly packaged, I think that leads to much more interesting language.
Mm-hmm. I see. I found a lot of interesting imagery in the St. Augustine poem. Mm-hmm. I liked the idea of this person who I think was almost a little bit frightening. Let's go climb a tower. Let's go break rules. Let's
which is not me at all. Yeah, I'm the tame, quiet one. I'll sit in the corner and observe. Yeah.
Let's have kisses on the stair landing and all of this. And I loved that. I don't know if you realize how erotic that poem is. Maybe you do.
I didn't. A friend pointed out to me, he said, oh my goodness.
Yeah, you know, we're touching things we shouldn't. Right. And we're handling knobs and we're doing all this stuff. And it's just like, wow, it's getting warm in here. But I love it. I love it because it's that beautiful use of metaphor that elevates it.
There's another poem in the collection called I Say Yes. And it's about domestic experiences. And when I workshopped that poem, many of my workshop colleagues who were other students, they said, you know, oh, you should build to an elaborate love scene, you know, mm-hmm. make it explicit. And I said, mm-hmm. the point of the poem is that it's not.
Right.
So when you're in love, it really doesn't matter that the content is not X-rated because mm-hmm. you're so in love that you can share an ice cream cone and it's just the most, you know, mm-hmm. ecstatic experience. And mm-hmm. so I resist, just like I resist profanity in my work, mm-hmm. I resist the urge to make it X-rated because where do you go from there? Yeah. First of all, then also you can't read it to a, you know, audience mm-hmm. of all ages. But also that art is supposed to do something a little more subtle than that.
Right.
And that in a poem you can wash dishes together and it can mean more. But mm-hmm. also, I love the idea of the St. Augustine poem and then the other one as well, because a relationship is about a rich tapestry of experiences together, not just what we think of as the textbook romantic experiences, mm-hmm. but that for someone like me, I'm not about to go climb a watchtower without help.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, and that in that poem, I did have a sore throat that day mm-hmm. and didn't feel super great, but the experience of the day made me forget it. And that by the end of the poem, I think you forget that the speaker had a sore throat.
Yes.
Because it didn't matter anymore. And that's how that day happened. And so I do resist. And it's funny because the instructor of that workshop did not share the student's opinion. She said, no, you should not push for mm-hmm. adult content, you know, because mm-hmm. you don't need it. If you have to go there, it means you can't say it any other way.
Yeah.
And also, again, that's not the only way to express romance.
Right. You know, I Say Yes, to me, that poem evokes Rhett Butler carrying Scarlett.
Oh, yes. Stairs. Oh, yes. I love that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just, he carries her up those stairs and you know what's going to happen.
Right.
And you don't have to see it because your imagination
better.
Is so much better.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's just a...
Well, and then you also think mm-hmm. if the couple doesn't have that rich repertoire of experience, the yes will not happen. So mm-hmm. What is a relationship made of but washing dishes and cleaning up and sharing experiences and crying on each other's shoulders? And that's what makes the content that we're not talking about so much more meaningful.
Right. I get it. And I'm glad that there are poets like you out there in the world expressing all these rich emotions and these beautiful experiences subtly. I think subtlety is a rare commodity these days. What does poetry mean to you? How would you define it?
When I think about poetry, I'm going to talk about my dog. when I wake up in the morning, the dog is already thumping his tail and he's excited to see me and he's alive. And even when he's sleeping, he's still moving and grunting and rolling around. And poetry is a language that's doing that. It's a language that's never fully asleep. It's a language that's always awake and alert and alive and versatile. And maybe you should never really be totally comfortable with it. But it's language with so much personality. And that doesn't mean loud. And just like we said, it doesn't mean in your face. But it's language that's always aware of itself. And it's always looking for something. And it's very much alive.
I like that. We were talking earlier over lunch, and you expressed that a writer has to always be paying attention, has to always be listening, even to other people's conversations, sort of a spy out there in the world,
yes.
Documenting the human condition. So talk to me about that. What's that like for you to pay close attention to what's going on? Because I know you like to write about nature and things like that.
I do. I'm a terrible eavesdropper. I eavesdrop all the time, so sorry to anyone who's close to me. I'm eavesdropping all the time.
Good for you. I teach that as a writing skill.
There you go. So, you know, if I'm sitting at my table waiting for a coffee, I'm listening to what everybody's saying around me, listening for characters, conflicts. What do these people really mean when they're talking to each other? And I'm one of those people that if I hear two people arguing, I can tell you what they are trying to tell each other. But that's not getting communicated. It is frustrating for me.
but you want to jump in there and
say, this is what she meant.
Yeah.
But you can't rescue everybody. And so, but in terms of nature, I'm fascinated by birds. I love birds. I love birding by ear. I try to figure out which birds are in my neighborhood. And a lot of times birders will tell you to put syllables to the bird song. So they'll say a cardinal sounds like they're saying very pretty, which I don't agree with. I don't agree with that for a cardinal, but I do like the idea of can you map the bird sounds in human speech? And so when I think about writing nature poems, a lot of that is kind of trying to translate something very musical, which is what does nature sound like, into the very limited resource of language. So I have quite a few poems about birds. I love birds. Mm-hmm. I only know about 7 species in my area, so I feel like a real beginner. But, you know, the idea that they call to each other, that they're having these conversations, that you can... I mean, there are just things that you can't pick up with human language, like crickets. How do you make the sound of crickets with your poetry? I don't know that you can. But I'm always listening to try to think about how could I create that.
Mm-hmm. You are very musical, and there's some relating, I believe, in your poetry between music and poetry.
Yes.
You likened it to a symphony in one interview I heard, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about how music and poetry relate for you.
Well, I think I was talking about the chapbook and what does a chapbook do? And a chapbook mm-hmm. is such a short collection of poems. And I heard one poet say, you know, treat every poem in the chapbook as a piece of one long poem. And so the whole collection has to read with a certain continuity.
Mm-hmm.
So like in a symphony where you'd have a slow movement and a fast movement and the emotions are shifting, but they're always calling back to earlier feelings and you're hearing themes repeated. Mm-hmm. It's the same for a collection of poetry. I don't want you to be shaken by something that you read on page 3. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're all going to call back to each other. And so I had so much fun. I sat down with a really good friend of mine and we rearranged the collection for about 3 hours. and it's so cool because when you put certain poems next to each other, then they highlight new features that you didn't notice.
Mm-hmm.
And I do return to certain topics a lot, but there are things that I didn't notice I returned to.
Mm-hmm.
And so like poem 3 would call to poem 7, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you think about all these poems talking to each other and being near each other and having someone experience this emotional landscape that you're creating. It is like a symphony or like an opera or I love classical music. I've been singing ever since I was little, all genres, you know, so I do use a lot of musical imagery in my work. I love poetry that is musical. I like poetry that's meant to be read aloud.
Mm-hmm. I had a similar experience when I met my husband, Brad Kuhn. He was on the Jack Kerouac House Project board of directors, and I was applying for a residency there. And we began to talk about Jack Kerouac's work, and we somewhat, you know, sheepishly confessed to one another that we really were not that huge fans of his work. We didn't understand, perhaps, or we just couldn't relate to some of his major themes and things. But then as we got more involved with the project and with one another, we started listening to Kerouac's poetry over bebop jazz. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it was just this magical awakening. You could hear that he was doing with words what Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk were doing with their musical instruments.
Yes.
And it was amazing and profound and wonderful. And, you know, the scales fell off our eyes more or less. And so I get it that there's just music that runs mm-hmm. through nature,
yes.
through the wind, through the bird song, through the waves. And it's in us. And it comes out as songs sometimes and as poems sometimes.
Right. And, you know, I had an experience. I was teaching a poetry class at FSCJ, and it was actually just a freshman composition class, but I always try to put one or two sessions on poetry, you know, focus on poetry just once or twice throughout the term. And we were reading a bunch of really eclectic poems. I mean, we had some sonnets. We had some William Carlos Williams. And a student was about to read a sonnet by Edna St. Vincent Millay, and she said, "Can I stand up and walk this sonnet?" And I said, "Sure." And she stood up and walked the sonnet around the room while she read it. I mean, she walked and recited, and the poem just came to life. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, that's meter. You know, meter is the mm-hmm. walking pace of the poem, and so mm-hmm. many people forget that your poetry is embodied. It's in your body. How do you experience any of this stuff if not through your hands and your eyes and your tongue and your feet?" And so I try to make my students get up and walk their work.
Wow.
Because you'll find the meter in what you wrote if you can walk it, and you'll, and the poem will leap off the page. And it's very cool.
Is this a skill that you had taught her? Or did
no,
she
taught
you?
Me. She taught
That's
me.
Incredible.
So it was really cool. Yeah. And I've never done that. I mean, I'm visually not able to read my work mm-hmm. while I walk it around the room. So I've never thought to do that. And so but I make them do it.
Yeah, now that you know about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's incredible what our students can sometimes teach us. I know that some of the people involved with Kerouac went to the Naropa School of Disembodied Poetics. And I'm wondering, what exactly is embodied poetics? That's a term I heard you use before.
A lot of disabled writers talk about embodiment in mm-hmm. art. And I think it's about writing from where you are in the world and being very aware of your body. And I always mm-hmm. thought I was very aware of my body until I took a class and writing in the body, and I realized how repressed I really was. Mm-hmm. And so it's about being willing to talk about, you know, how things feel, how you're standing, how you're sitting, bringing yourself very fully onto the page in a very physical way. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in a romantic way, so it could be just your opening mail, you know, but being willing to talk about your experience of that. I think for a blind poet or a poet with some limited vision, it would be talking about what you actually see instead of the very cleaned up version of what ends up on the page, you know? Mm-hmm. So, the times that I have mistaken a shrubbery for a person and said, excuse me, you know, and not wanted to talk about that in a poem, I think an embodied poet would not be afraid to talk about that. Uh-huh. So for disabled writers, it's not necessarily activist writing, but it is writing from what their experience of the world is like in the bodies that they have.
Mm-hmm. Do you introduce yourself as a blind poet, and you use the word disabled, and I'm interested because it's, you know, as a person who tries to move through the world in as inoffensive way as possible, I'm always interested in the words that people choose to use to describe themselves, and I wondered if you find that you are asked to be a representative for any group like that, and how you feel about that request to represent, because, you know, we're all individuals and we all mm-hmm. bring who we are, the complete package with us. So are you ever asked to be representative of, say, blind people or disabled people, and how does that feel?
Yes, I would say that I am. I call myself a blind poet because I'm going to show up with a guide dog and dark glasses, and I'm going to need large print. I do have some vision. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to need some accommodations. And so if I show up and I don't call myself a blind poet, people are too shocked. And they kind of are, you know, kicked back a little bit, and they go, oh, you know, oh, you're here. Mm-hmm. Oh, are you lost? You know, mm-hmm. so if I say I'm a blind poet, I find that if I own the term, they can prepare, such as mm-hmm. it is. And it's not a term I'm ashamed of, and disabled mm-hmm. is not a term I'm ashamed of. Right. So that's part of why I do it, so that, you know, when I show up, you kind of know what to expect. Mm-hmm. Because the shock is not nice. Mm-hmm. you're here. Are you really? Are you sure? You know, the number of students when I walk into a classroom that think I'm a student, you know, because mm-hmm. they couldn't imagine having a blind instructor. You know, they ask, can I help you find a seat? And I say, I'm the teacher. And they go, oh, you know, so that's not a nice feeling when you're not what people expected. Mm-hmm. And they usually get over it. But again, it's not super great. So
just that awkward moment.
Yeah, it's, you know, yeah. you're not what we mm-hmm. expected. So I call myself a blind poet for that reason. I also call myself a blind poet because my work addresses disability. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to tell you the Tiny Tim story of inspiration, where disability is automatically compensated with spiritual insight, or this can-do attitude, you know, that is often linked with stories of disability. And again, it's not a tragic story. Mm-hmm. Blindness is not tragic for me. It's not the most painful thing I've ever experienced. So that's another reason to put that word out there. Mm-hmm. And also, it's not a word that I'm afraid of. So sometimes people don't want to use it because they see it as somehow insulting. Mm. You know, oh, are you blind? You know, lower your voice, kind mm-hmm. of wink, right. wink, nudge, nudge. And yes, I am. And it's just a fact of life. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think sometimes there's a representation factor. I think people have not met that many blind people. And so I'm usually the first one they've ever met. And some people get over it and some people don't. Mm-hmm. And usually the people that don't are not people that stick around my social circle for very long because it's exhausting, you know, yeah. to deal with someone who can't ever get past the fact that I live in the world differently from you, but really we all like ice cream, you know, we all want to be in love, you know, we all love dogs. I mean, you know, it's right. really not that big of a deal. And, mm-hmm. And it can go the other way too, to the point where people say, oh, I forgot. I totally don't think of you as disabled. Mm-hmm. Which means you forgot the help I asked you for, you yeah. know, you know, or you forgot to enlarge my work because you said, oh, I don't think of you as disabled. Well, that's mm-hmm. nice for you, but
it's like people who say, I don't see color.
Oh, sure. Exactly. Or, you know,
like, what?
I don't think of don't you as silly. Old, you know, and it's yeah. like, well, what does old mean? You right. know? So, yeah. So acceptance is what everybody wants.
Yeah. You know? We all want to be known in our totality and mm-hmm. appreciated, and allowances made for the help we need. I'm interested, too, in that You mentioned Little York, you know.
Oh, yes.
He's such a help, and
that's wonderful.
He's a feisty little curious guy and all of that. I was fed a question that I thought was absolutely fascinating by someone who obviously wants to know the answer. But what is something that York knows about you that no one else knows?
Oh, that's such a good question. York knows when I am feeling very vulnerable. And I will try to talk about this without crying. But York knows when I'm scared. He knows when I don't feel confident. He knows when I'm sitting on the bedroom floor crying, and I am a private crier. If I'm crying in public, it means leave me alone. I do not want people to come up and go, honey, it's going to be okay. You know, get away from me. That's just how I am. I don't, maybe it's because I am a blind person. I can't judge someone from a distance the way that a sighted person can. And so if you see someone crying, you can go up to them. But for me, it feels like all eyes are on me because I can't reciprocate in that way. And I feel like I'm under a spotlight. So I often, if I feel very overwhelmed emotionally, I seek a private place. Mm-hmm. And York is always with me. I mean, he's never away from me. So he knows when I am feeling very desperate, vulnerable, scared. And even when I'm walking around and I'm feeling that way, he knows. And there have been many times when I'm nervous and I don't realize I'm nervous until York starts rolling on the floor. Mm-hmm. And I realize that he's trying to get me to laugh or to loosen up. Mm-hmm. He did that once and I was getting my photo taken for a recent interview. And I thought I was doing okay. And then I realized York was acting out. I thought, why is he acting like that? And he was rolling himself against me and licking my leg and being just absolutely adorable. And I loosened up. And then I realized that he was helping me loosen up. And wow. I didn't know that I needed to. So, you know, we all think we're superheroes, you know. And I thought, I'm fine. But I wasn't fine. And he knew that. And he's much more adventurous than I am. And he often works better in a much more crowded area than I would be comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, York helps me to be a little more adventurous than I would normally be. And he's just so brave in ways that I'm not, that he knows when I need him to be the brave one.
Wow. I think we all need a friend like that. How do you think he does it? Is it a difference in your breathing? How do you think he knows when you're tense and afraid?
Probably breathing, probably posture. Mm-hmm. I know animals are very visual, so they look at us as pictures, you know, basically walking pictures. Yeah. And I always used to notice that York would know when it was time to leave a restaurant. And I thought, how does he know that? And I realized that the only time I reach for my purse is to get the wallet. Uh-huh. So he always knew, she's paying the check, we're leaving.
Smart boy.
So I noticed that. I thought, wow, so I wonder what picture I'm showing him. And especially in public, because of course in private, I know that I'm upset. Mm-hmm. But in public, when I'm nervous or scared, I don't know what I'm showing him, but I think he's catching on to, I'm usually pretty calm. You know, I'm a pretty calm person. And so if I am tense, I'm sure he can sense it in my breathing or the way that I'm walking.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's fascinating. I want to bring us back around to the riding. I sort of got off track because your sweet dog fascinates me. A lot of our listeners are riders, a lot of people use a term I don't like very much, aspiring riders. To me, if you're riding, you're a rider.
Yes.
Whether you're published or not,
in or out. Yes.
People will say they're aspiring riders, and I don't quite get it.
What are they aspiring to? You know,
they're aspiring to be rich and
famous. It's never going to happen.
Authors, no. Which is you know, perfectly fine, I guess. But if you're a rider, it's because you're riding.
Yes.
However, what would you say to young writers who want to be you when they grow up and have a chapbook and maybe teach and share their wisdom about writing? What advice would you give them? And
pay attention and seek out mentors. So I wrote privately for a long time, and I had friends who would read my work. In fact, funny story about Joel. I would always send him my poems at like midnight, you know. Mm. I wrote this about my, you know, family, read it. And then I'd get highly offended if he didn't read it immediately. I didn't really take into account that he was living his own life. But, you know, I always would send him work and he would always encourage me. And I had other friends that I would send work to and they would encourage me. I never thought my work would have a public profile at all. I thought, well, I like to write. And I didn't really work on my work. That was me kind of just writing the kind of poems that most high school, college kids write. And then you put it away and, you know, you don't ever do anything with it. And then I started to think about working on my work, mainly to avoid the meltdown that happens after grad school when you graduate and you think, what am I going to do with my life?
No more deadlines.
But it's kind of scary because mm-hmm. you think, well, you know, what if I don't make new friends? What if I don't mm-hmm. find a job? You've defined yourself as a student for so long and all of a sudden you're not a student anymore. So to avoid that meltdown, I started to enter my work into, you know, calls for submissions. And then it started to get some acceptance. And I had a couple of editors who would write to me and tell me how much they liked what I was sending in. And then they would start asking me for work. And that was really cool. And I did think they were just being very nice. I thought, oh, they're so nice. They're so generous. And then a friend of mine said, quit thinking about it like that. Mm-hmm. They like what you have to say. And then when I started to blog, I did start a blog. People, even in my own family, would come up and say, I learned things about you that I never knew. Mm-hmm. And I thought, really? And then they'd say, oh, I love reading your blog. I never thought anybody would like that. I wrote it because I enjoyed writing the essays on my blog. Mm-hmm. But blogging every couple of weeks helped me to be able to write a fast essay. Now, if I see a prompt that I'd like to respond to, I can write a pretty good essay in 2 or 3 days because I blogged for a long time without any thought of publication beyond, you know, WordPress. Mm-hmm. So pay attention, keep a list of ideas. What would you like to talk about? What would you like to write about? And then find people who will encourage you and help you become more professional.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the people that encouraged you? I think particularly of Professor Gabbard, is it, at UNF?
Oh, yes.
Who was a wonderful champion of yours. Tell us about him and anyone else that comes to mind. I put words in your mouth.
Sure, no, that's fine.
I hope that was a good one.
That's fine, yes. So I took a class with Chris mm-hmm. Gabbard as an undergrad, and then we kind of connected, mainly because Chris had actually forgotten to bring my large print quiz to class, mm-hmm. and I said something really sassy and rude, which I never would have said. I don't know. I was just over it. I said, well, forget it, you know, or, you know, something, mm-hmm. you know, well, one day you'll see how it feels or something, mm-hmm. and that kind of broke down the wall between us, and he, you know, we started to talk more honestly to each other about disability. And of course, Chris had a son with many disabilities, and so I didn't know that at the time. Mm-hmm. I thought he was just some guy who didn't understand what my people were going through. So, you know,
and as his new memoir points out, he understood all too well.
Oh, exactly. So we had a much more honest relationship after that, and then I would come to his classes and talk about blindness whenever he talked about disability. And then I took a class in grad school with him and worked as his TA. And so he pushed me to develop professional skills. He told me I would not get a degree in medieval literature and become a medievalist because I wouldn't find a job. And I was very depressed.
Thanks,
for about,
Dad.
Yeah, 5 minutes. Yeah, exactly. He said, you will not do that. And I said, okay, fine. And then Michael Northen was another incredible mentor for me. And the funny thing is I've never met him in person. He is has been the editor of Word Gathering for 30 years and is just an incredible force in the disability community, even though he's not disabled himself. And he published my first poems, and I did think he was just so nice, and how kind of you to take my work. I thought, well, maybe he had room to fill, and then I realized, oh, it's a digital issue. That's not actually true. So, but he kept calling on me for more work. Would you send me an essay about this? Do you have anything I could use? And I was a young poet, I mean, early 20s, very few credits, you know, and then there was an opportunity to guest edit the poetry section of that journal for a while, and I thought, okay, why not? And he said, I think you can do it. And then he started asking me to write book reviews. And I thought, well, that's really cool. So then he started recommending me to other people. And then something about the disability community in terms of writers is everybody knows everybody. And so again, a lot of these people I have never met physically, they kept recommending my work to other people. And they'd say, oh, so-and-so gave me your name. And I'm thinking, what? You know, these are people who are on the front of collections of poetry, and how do they know who I am? But it's a very close-knit community, and everybody's so encouraging that I really have gotten a lot of help and mentorship from that.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing as a common theme that I can, you know, pass on from you to the listeners is that take these opportunities as they come along. You were asked to edit this and contribute to that, and there's this great big need out there. There's this giant gaping hole in the cyberspace and in print media, and waiting for quality content.
Yes.
Yeah. So to be unafraid to submit, to be okay if you're rejected in one place because your poem has a home, you just haven't found it yet, or your story or your essay, just keep getting it out there, and then people will start to recognize quality work and will start to help you and recommend you.
And sometimes you'll submit to something and they'll write back to you and say, we loved what you sent, but it doesn't fit with what we've already put together. Mm-hmm. So keep us in mind, you know. And then also there's near misses. Like one of the things in my bio is about my first chapbook. That was a third place in a contest for young poets. Wasn't first place, it wasn't second place, so it didn't get published, but it was third place. And you know what? When you're a poet, if they call you a finalist or they call you an honorable mention, you can brag about that.
Yes, absolutely.
So and just like I begin to understand Joe March was the was a finalist for the Atlantis Award. Well, it didn't win, but it's a finalist, which means somebody really liked it. And there were a handful that were almost at the top, and you don't have to be at the top. A lot of times journals will publish the finalists and the honorable mentions. They'll publish, if not your whole collection, they'll publish a handful of poems. And they'll do a nice profile on you. And then you can tell other people, hey, I was a finalist. And those editors will often write to you and say, keep sending us your work. If an editor tells you, keep sending us your work, please keep sending them your work. They mean it.
They're not being nice.
They're not being
nice. They don't have time to be nice. They want to fill their...
Yes.
publications with quality work. So they're certainly not reaching out to someone that they don't think has talent to say, please keep sending us your work so that I can read and reject it. I promise you that's not happening. So tell the young writers in Jacksonville what opportunities there are here and what they should be doing to join the writing community.
Workshops. There's a lot of local workshops. Sometimes they're attached to FSCJ or UNF, but sometimes they're just the library, or they're attached to Jacks by Jacks, which is our yearly writing festival. Workshops are amazing. And even if you don't get good critiques, you get the experience of learning how to critique in a really meaningful way. And bad critiques can still help you, just like reading bad poetry can help you become a better poet, because you learn what not to do. So workshops, definitely. And then attending Jacks by Jacks, which I have read at a few times. And it's just really cool to come out and hear all the different writing that's going on in the city. But also, you know, if you feel like you don't fit in with the writers community, don't be discouraged by that. The community is always growing and changing. And I remember one time I went to a party for a magazine launch. And the room was really dark and everybody kept tripping over York, so I had to leave. So I thought, you know, this really isn't my scene. And I wasn't discouraged by that. I just knew that that wasn't really for me, and I would wait until I could find something that was for me. So maybe the writing scene right now doesn't feel like it fits you. You don't have to change to fit the scene. Start to plan events that you want to be at. I plan all the events at UNF for National Poetry Month in April because I like poetry, not because my students like it. And I think, well, if I like it, maybe they'll come out. So if the writing scene is not what you want, think about what you do want and start trying to plan, even if it's just an informal gathering at the library. But don't be afraid if the scene doesn't seem to fit you, or you feel like you're not cool enough, or you're not, you don't want to stand in a dark room and drink expensive drinks, you know? So
sounds kind of nice.
I know it does. It does a little bit. Yeah. But, Jacks by Jacks is a big deal for our local writers. It's a very cool way to be able to get the experience of reading for an audience, which you need to do. And I wouldn't have done that without friends pressuring me to go do that. I said, no, I'm never going to read in public. And a friend of mine said, yes, you are. And this is what you're going to do. And so I had to do that.
Here's to bullying friends who tell us what's good for us, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time that I encouraged my husband Brad to enter a contest and read a poem. It was a contest that I had been trying to win for several years. I would send in my work, and the prize was $500 in publication. So I was pretty much excited about that. Wanted to win that, and I never got any of the finalist or honorable mention or anything like that. Certainly never won it. And the year that I encouraged him to do it, we both entered, and I told him, now, don't get your hopes up. It's really tough. It's really competitive. And he got up at the contest. You had to actually, read your work there. And he got up, and he was shaking so badly that the paper rattled. I wondered how he was even going to read what was on the page. But it was a wonderful poem, and you know where this is going.
He won. Did he win?
He won the $500 prize.
Of course.
I, for the first time, got an honorable mention. Asked me how much my prize money was.
Nothing.
Yeah. They patted me on the head and said, what a good girl. But he won the money. And you know what I told him after that? I told him two things. I said, congratulations, and pick your own darn contest. I'm not helping you ever again.
I think that's funny.
It was great. We're just about out of time. This hour has flown. I've really, really enjoyed our conversation. And I'm just wondering, what would you like the world to know about Emily K. Michael that I have forgotten to ask you?
I don't know that it's anything about me. I want people to be a little more imaginative in what they're willing to do. I want people to know that poetry is not scary or intimidating. I want people to know that if they read a poem and don't connect with it, it doesn't mean they're a bad person. It might mean it's a bad poem. And I want people to slow down, quiet down, and pay attention, and to try to find something that they could write about, even if they never actually write about it. I think I want people to be more attentive. And so it's not really about me. It's more about what is the change I would want to see in others. And it's that I want them to be quiet and a little more attentive to what's going on in the world, whether it's their personal world or nature or their lives. I just see a great need for more attention, quiet attention.
And with that, I want to thank you for joining us. And I'm going to take your words to heart and try to pay some quiet attention to the world around me this week. Thanks for coming to River of Grass. Scribbler's Corner is produced by Brad Kuhn and Associates, a multimedia production company making authors' dreams come true for almost a decade. BKNA offers a full print shop with design services for everything from books to bookmarks and banners, digital audio recording, video book trailers, and animation, priced for self-published authors and indie publishers. The Corner is also brought to you by the Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival, Jacksonville Writers Writing Jacksonville, now in its sixth year. Writer applications open July 1st for this year's event, which will be held on Saturday, November 16th. And finally, a podcast wouldn't be a podcast without listeners like you. If you like what you're hearing and want me to keep doing it, please do me the favor of subscribing and spreading the word by telling at least one friend about us.